Hey, welcome back, everybody, to the Using Microsoft VDI to Enable New Work Styles. Lunch. It's a jumpstart. Corey's over here in a meat coma. Lunch.
Lunch was good.
Yeah.
Lunch was good.
Hope everybody out there had a good little meal break. We're going to jump back in, talk a little bit about Hyper-V for VDI. But first, there's a couple of things from the Q&A pane that we wanted to address right off the bat, and a couple of things I want to cover. So, Corey?
I don't know if I call it the Q&A pane.
Sorry, from the Q&A queue.
Yes, list. Because we don't think it's a pain. We enjoy
it. No, question. I'm looking at it in a pain. Really?
Yes.
Okay, would you answer the question,
excellent,
please?
Someone wanted to know, was there an administrative template for group policy for RemoteFX? I'm assuming that question comes because you went on a server, opened group policy, and went digging through and couldn't find anything. That's because the settings exist on a Windows 8 client. So as long as you edit the policy from a Windows 8 client, you'll see them and you'll be fine. So there isn't an ADM per se. It's already there, but it's on the client. So if you're doing your group policy editing from a server, you're not going to see the totality of the RemoteFX group policy available options. And number two, is there a hybrid deployment option between session pooled and private? Now, I'm assuming it doesn't mean hybrid is in battery powered, so we're going to assume it's a, and you know, I really don't know what the definition of hybrid is in this case, but let me put it this way. You can have a deployment that contains any combination of remote app, pooled, personal, and sessions. There are four distinct options that you have. There's no crossover per se between them, but your overall RDS deployment can be any number of collections of any of those types. So I can have two pools and two pools of private. I can have four pools of pooled. This is getting hard, difficult to say. You know, a bunch of remote app
collections.
Things, bunch of collections. So you can have all those things, and it'll be just fine. But there's no crossover necessarily between them. Collections are distinct entities, and your deployment will be multiple collections of whatever the valid types are.
A couple other things that I kind of wanted to jump up and hit. First of all, application virtualization and AppV is an excellent companion to dealing with both pooled VDI as well as private VDI. I love it in pooled in the fact that if you want to really do a great job of deploying and implementing pooled VDI, you want those master images to be as small as possible, mm-hmm, and not bloat them out with a whole ton of applications. And the same thing holds true here with private or personal desktops, right? With the private VDI. However, with pooled, the great thing is user logs on, you're not worried about what apps they're using because they're virtualized and they'll get those applications. Mm-hmm. And you maintain that nice streamlined kind of base image that you've got going there.
Brings up an interesting topic, okay? And this is a little bit of a segue into something that we're not really covering all that much in here. I'll do my best to explain this, right? But when you look at pooled and private desktops, okay, traditionally, typically, most often, a pooled desktop is going to have some sort of shared VHD differencing disk linked clone style storage model.
Yes.
Okay. Traditionally, a private desktop is going to have a monolithic 1 VHD to 1 VM storage model. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't have to be the case. You can, with pooled desktop images, do monolithic VHDs. If you were to pre-deploy everything, that's probably what you'd wind up with, and you just manage those VHDs with Server Manager. You could also, and this is one of the things that Citrix does with their PVS product when you do an integrated solution, you can actually have this linked clone model for VHDs still in personal desktops. And I would argue that where you choose to put the applications, whether it's baked into the master image or somewhere else hosted, whether they're hosted through remote app, terminal server, ZenApp type stuff, or whether they're streamed in with AppV, it matters more what the storage model is than what the usage model is. Because if you're going to pre-install Office and then clone that VHD 50 times, that's 50 Office gigabits times 50 of storage.
Yes.
Whereas if you were going to use a single master image and do differencing disks, the fact that you've put Office in the gold image has much less of an impact on the grand scheme of things.
Sure.
So,
but still a minor impact on your storage, right?
Sure, absolutely.
And then, you know, of course, the larger the VHD is, the more when you're moving it around and you're
absolutely
kind of patching.
And that's certainly a very advanced topic. That when you're getting into planning VDI, that's a much more advanced sort of set of considerations you would make that the average person that's getting this off the ground probably isn't even really thinking all that much about. But just something, a little bit more on the advanced side for those of you that are paying attention to that.
Awesome. Somebody says SQL for Life just says that you remind him of Gary Sinise. Wonders if you like Apollo 13, sorry.
I'm not sure how to take that, but I will. Speaking of people out in the Twitterverse, with the videos that they post on the Microsoft Virtualization Academy, right? So there's assessment questions that they put at the end of the video,
sure.
So you can see what you watch the videos. And those questions get written live, by the way. And so there's a guy
there today.
Well, going forward, they get written live. So there's a guy right now watching this who's writing down assessment questions. His name's Kyle, and his Twitter handle is Windows PC Guide. He's in Australia, and I only mention him because I just got a ping from someone going, "It's like 3 a.m. He took a nap. He hasn't woken up yet." So, Kyle, if you're there. Let us know.
Wake up, Kyle.
We need to know if you're there, buddy. Thank you.
Wake up, Kyle. All right. Let's jump right into Module 4, which is Hyper-V for VDI. And this is a really important module. We've covered Hyper-V in some of the other jumpstarts that we've had. Rick's covered it in his. Simon's done a great job. Simon Perriman, another guy on my team, has done a great job in his jumpstarts. But the main reason we wanted to cover this again is how important Hyper-V is to VDI, because it's the underlying piece when you start doing pooled and private VMs. And the more important piece about Hyper-V, not just the Hyper-V service itself, but it's the storage aspect. So that's really kind of what we're going to cover here. So give you just a quick little intro, 5-second, 30-second intro on Hyper-V and some of the components. And then we're really going to kind of get into SMB and SANs and the storage tiers and clustering for and storage spaces. And really, basically, all you have to do is on this particular topic, Corey, is wind you up, and you're gonna continue to go on because you have got a lot of great practical experience in actually going in and implementing this when you run these labs and you run these type of environments. So I really wanted to make sure that folks gain as much knowledge from your practical personal implementation.
And it's also worth mentioning, by the way, that this entire thing's on VDI. This next section is more generically Hyper-V focused on VDI. But if you want more and you're going to TechEd, we're doing a whole pre-con on this stuff. So an entire day on Windows Server 2012 next generation IT infrastructure. So storage, networking, system center, VDI, virtualization, all that foundational, what we call the fabric now, all that fabric stuff in Windows Server 2012. So it's a whole day, and you can go on the TechEd site and register for that.
Yeah, if you want that website, it's msteched.com. TechEd North America is going to be in New Orleans the first part of June, and then a couple of weeks later in Madrid. For Europe is the pre-con also available.
It's also available in Europe.
So no matter which TechEd you go to, check that out. Unfortunately, pre-cons are an additional fee, so they're not recorded, but I highly recommend checking out your session there.
I'm worth an additional fee. I don't know how much, but...
50 cents.
I got a dollar or something here.
All right. Very quickly, jump in, and I've got a slide up here on Hyper-V architecture, just in case people aren't aware of the Hyper-V architecture and how Hyper-V kind of works.
So, at its most fundamental level, and this is, if you go look at any recorded session on Hyper-V anywhere in the world, especially the earlier ones, this is a topic they would cover a lot, which is, what is Hyper-V? And essentially, it's a hypervisor that allows you to create and define virtual machines. Virtual machines run in what are known as child partitions, which are partitioned off areas of the computer. They can't talk to each other unless you configure appropriate networking, and they communicate with something called the host partition or the parent partition using a technology called VMBus. With Windows, you want to go to the next slide there.
Sure.
Windows is what's often called a...
go back.
Come on, Joey, you can do it.
I'm telling it to.
There we go. Windows is what's often referred to as a microkernelized hypervisor. And essentially what this means is the drivers, and this is where you get a significant benefit with Hyper-V, the drivers are loaded in what's known as the parent partition. The parent partition, in all practical terms, is what you install before you install Hyper-V. So it's that initial install of Windows. When you install Hyper-V, at the raw technical level, that base install of Windows becomes a VM. Mm-hmm. It's just managed interactively as opposed to through a management tool. But it uses all the drivers. And so when you install Hyper-V, you get the driver stack of Windows. And anything that Windows can use, Hyper-V can use. So it results in a very small, very fast, very stable hypervisor. In the other model that's frequently used, which is called monolithic, the hypervisor contains the drivers, so you need vendor-specific drivers for hardware. Mm-hmm. One of the great things about Windows for this implementation is that it has drivers. You know, there isn't a piece of hardware you don't have a Windows driver for. That's the first thing they build, and then other drivers for it.
Yep. So. Yeah, absolutely. Just kind of historical context, right, just before we get into the improvements, right? So Windows Server started offering Hyper-V in Windows Server 2008, right?
It was a post-release add-on.
Correct. But part of the operating system, right?
Yep.
And it's really kind of morphed into a pretty integral part of the operating system. We introduced an update to it in Windows Server 2008 R2, right? So you've got the Hyper-V introduced in Windows Server 2008, Hyper-V Server, which is basically, and you use Hyper-V Server
yes.
a lot. It's essentially just Hyper-V,
exactly.
No underlying Windows Server OS.
And it's free. It is the hardware hosting capability of data center
mm-hmm.
for free, but only for VMs. So you can't run a file server on it. You can't run a web server on it. All it'll do is Hyper-V. It comes with Hyper-V pre-installed. There's about 16 features available. One of them is virtualization host. It is, in my mind, the only choice when it comes to doing VDI. Because you get, well, first of all, and Adam will get into this in the licensing, but when you buy Windows Server, you get Hyper-V, you get some OS equivalency licenses.
Mm-hmm.
So you can run, and I may be wrong, if you have Enterprise Edition, a Standard Edition, you get a one VM license. Mm-hmm. That may have changed since, but there's some OS equivalency license. With Data Center, I believe it's still unlimited,
yes.
But only for server OSs. You don't get any licenses for client OSs.
Absolutely.
So, you know, with me as a consultant, why would I buy a copy of Windows to put clients on it when I get no licensing benefit, when I can use the free one, which has the hardware power of Data Center, still goes into domain, still gets managed by VMM, still gets managed by System Center, still can be clustered, still does everything. And I'm going to run an unlimited number of desktop OSs, as many as the hardware let me do it. I don't got to pay for the hypervisor, and the OS licenses for the desktops are paid for through Software Assurance or VDA or what, or some of those other acronyms Adam's going to use.
Yeah, absolutely. When we released Server 2008 R2 in October of 2009, we made some pretty significant changes and added additional features, things like live migration to move virtual machines around without having any downtime, the ability to use clustered shared volumes, and we're going to get yep. into that when we start talking about storage. Processor compatibility, right, mm-hmm. where you're moving from one version of an Intel processor up to another version
of
an Intel processor.
Yeah, and the processor compatibility, if you've ever run a production cluster, and a year and a half in, one of your nodes fails, and you go, oh, geez, my node failed, and you want to replace it, so you migrate all your VMs off, or it's going to fail, you migrate all your VMs off, and you go buy the new one, but you go back to Dell or HP or IBM or whomever, and they go, yeah, we don't sell that generation anymore. The only thing you can buy is this newer generation, which is not 100% the same as what you have right now. So now you've got a mismatch in your cluster, and your live migration starts to fail
mm-hmm.
because you got a processor mismatch. The compatibility mode uses a lowest common denominator sort of model for processor features. It doesn't expose everything. It exposes a subset, so that even these different processors become compatible. And you can go from like a Pentium 4 to an i7. It's that wide a range.
Right. Another couple of key features for me when we made the improvements there, hot add storage. I mean, mm-hmm. when you're running VMs, being able to add storage.
Well, the hot add storage is what makes user profile disk possible.
Absolutely.
Right? It's only on the SCSI bus, mm-hmm. Which is where they add the user profile disk mount point. But that's why they work, because you can hot add that VHD and hot remove the VHD while the VM's running.
And then in February of 2011, we introduced SP1 for Windows Server 2008 R2. So Windows Server 2008 R2 SP1. Dynamic memory, remote FX. Two technologies that are leveraged quite a bit when we start talking.
Well, one could argue those are for VDI. Right, that the primary purpose of those, and you know, the Hyper-V guys, you know, Jeff Woolsey might correct me on that, but you know, as a consultant out there, I look at those two features and I go, that's what enables VDI to function so well, because server workloads, their memory consumption is horribly predictable. And like, if you're going to virtualize a SQL server or an Exchange server or something else, there's a web page on Microsoft.com somewhere that will tell you X users, mailboxes, input, output, this much memory, put it in and go. It's not going to fluctuate. Whereas with users, you don't know what they're going to do, when they're going to do it. I mean, you don't know if forgive me, you know, if there's a tweet about Justin Bieber and all of a sudden all your users are hitting up some Facebook website to go download a video, you don't know what people are going to do. And so being able to move memory around in waves from these desktops to this desktop as they need it and then release it back again is, so you know, is significant, because you no longer have to capacity plan for the high watermark of memory usage. You don't got to sit there and go, well, you know, I figure at most they're going to need 4 gigs. So you don't go 4 gigs times the number of desktops. You now go, I think on average they're going to need 2 gigs. So you go 2 gigs times the number of desktops. You let remote and you let dynamic memory kind of absorb the fluctuations over time.
So we typically hear oversubscribing, overcommit, I think is a term that's used quite a bit, with memory, and let's try to cram as much in as possible. Dynamic memory handles this a lot differently.
Yeah, it looks like an oversubscription model, and one could argue that from a capacity planning standpoint it kind of is, because you're planning based on the average, not the max. But you're betting on it. It is a bet, and it is, you know, it's something you got to think about and plan, but you're betting on the fact that they're not all going to want the max at the same time.
Yeah.
And rather than tricking the VM to think it has more memory than it actually does, you actually give it more memory. And you let it have real, honest-to-God memory, and then when it doesn't need it, you bring it back down again.
Yeah, absolutely. So now we're at Windows Server 2012 and Windows Server 2012 Hyper-V. And this is all about the scale, baby. I mean, this is really what we've done, is we've taken all those functional improvements. Now it's time to scale it out. Now it's time to really kind of, you know, really push things to the limit. So in Server 2008 R2 Hyper-V, we only supported 64 logical processors. We now support up to 320. Physical memory, up to 4 terabytes in Windows Server 2012. Virtual CPUs per host, 2048. Do you have a host that's running 2048 virtual CPUs, Corey?
No, I have, the most I have, I think, is 32, which is 4x6 core.
So there you go there.
No. 64.
Yep.
And 4x6 by hyper-threading.
There you go. There you go. Virtual memory per VM up to 1 terabyte, right? You've got memory and disk are the two things in virtualization that are
exactly right. Our standard server build at the moment is about a 400 gig memory footprint, and that is because we want to distribute. It's you start talking about like super scale servers and that kind of thing. At some point, you know, when you start getting into 1 terabyte of memory and 500, you know, you got to start thinking about, do I have bottlenecks in the PCI bus at that stage? Mm-hmm. And so we found, you know, for what we do, our sweet spot's around 400 gig per server. And then by distributing that across servers, we get a really, really good balance of performance and scale. And also you look at cost. When you go to a, you know, 512 to a gig of RAM, the server cost goes up quite rapidly. We're not in our own environment touching some of those scale individual per server scale numbers, but you know, I'll run 400 VMs on a server.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, in VDI scenarios, high density is key. You know, server virtualization, you're running a small number of workloads per server. Desktop virtualization, you're running very high dense workloads, and those workloads are very disk intensive, more so than CPU intensive.
Yeah, absolutely. So for Hyper-V server, it was available in Server 2008 R2. Hyper-V server is still free and available for
absolutely
Windows Server 2012. So I saw a question here that says, is Hyper-V 2008 R2 still free and downloadable? Where can I find it? I'm sure it's still out there, but you'll probably want to go ahead and just jump up to Windows Server 2012 Hyper-V. And the other question, kind of along the same line is, okay, so for the RD virtualization host server, can it be server 2012 with Hyper-V, or can it just be,
it can be
Hyper-V server?
It can be Hyper-V server.
Okay.
So Hyper-V server supports that role. It's a component you add to. It's not added by default. It's a component you can just add into. So it fully supports that role. And that's the one I'd install. I wouldn't install full unless I want to do remote effects stuff. Remote effects stuff with because we didn't really get into the, we talked about the virtual GPU, but not the physical GPU.
Yeah.
If you want to do physical GPU mapping because you've got DirectX 11 requirements, you've got to go full-on addition to get that. But otherwise, Hyper-V server is the way to go.
Sure. There's a lot of in-depth detailed questions coming up around Hyper-V specific kind of things. And,
yeah, we don't
and I hate
get,
to do
yeah,
this.
We don't want to get bogged down in those.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to point you guys. There's a bunch of different Jumpstart stuff. Rick Claus does one on Windows Server 2012. Simon Perriman just did a whole slew of stuff out on Microsoft Virtual Academy around Hyper-V for VMware professionals,
yep,
so they get up to speed. So I'm going to kind of push those off to the side, and I really want to jump into the next piece, which is the Hyper-V for VDI components. And I just saw a question pop up right here. Yes, there is a free Hyper-V server for Windows Server 2012. It's easily found using your favorite search engine. You can go out and download that.
What's your favorite search engine, Joey?
That would be Bing. That would be Bing.
My Kool-Aid?
Yeah, all right. All right. Yeah, I'm a Microsoft guy. I'm not ashamed about it. So let's talk about the VDI components within Hyper-V.
Okay. Before we do that, I've got to go touch my touchpad.
Okay, go touch.
1 second.
So the key piece here, and the key piece around a lot of virtualization is storage. And storage, and Adam's going to get to this when we talk about scale, but storage in Hyper-V and around some of the enhancements that we have in Server 2012, right? Where you've got the ability to scale out and leverage all sorts of storage technology.
One of the most common questions I get when I talk to people about Windows Server 2012 is, okay, you know, biggest new thing, what is it, right? There's two things. Hyper-V has gotten massive overhaul. A lot of the overhaul that's come in Hyper-V is directly around storage, which is the second thing, which is the file server. I tell you what, it's been a long time since Microsoft invented a file server. With 2012, they invented a file server. This is not the file server that we've had for the last 20 years. This is a brand new notion of a file server, which is this idea of a file server for application data. And we'll get to some of that a bit later on, but those are the two single biggest things. And because of that, it now gives you the opportunity to fundamentally re-architect your data center, to rethink how you do everything from your SAN topologies to where you run expensive fiber, to what type of Ethernet you're going to run, to your subnet topology, and really reimagine it, reallocate roles where, you know, in the simplest example, let's say you want to do traditionally, you want to set up a SQL database. Here's kind of how it goes, right? Buy a server, put it in the data center, and then some guy in the data center is going to carve out a LUN on a SAN, plumb some fiber, present the LUN, and now you've got storage for your SQL server. But that activity of plumbing the fiber, carving up the LUN, I've managed LUNs and SANs and fiber switching zones. It's not easy, and I've broken it so many bloody times I can't even count. It's like, it's one of those things where, you know, I'm afraid to hit that save button because it's just, I kind of know how it works, but I just,
you kind of flinch a little bit.
It's just, it's horribly terrifying. It's hard to do. It takes a lot of expertise. It's vendor specific. It costs a lot of money, and it limits flexibility. With the new file server, when the SQL guy needs storage, you give him a file share.
Yeah, because really, Windows Server 2012, and particularly because we're talking about VDI and remote desktop services, there's lower cost storage options. SMB attached file shares or direct attached storage, in addition to these great big huge complex SANs that you have to deal with. So really, you know, whether it's direct attached or network attached or SAN storage, we support it. And the performance along these lines, particularly, and you're going to get into this, there are some serious performance considerations that you need to take into your thinking before you go out and start dumping dumping a bunch of money into these very expensive storage systems. So let's look very quickly at VDI storage and Hyper-V. So there, storage is key, no question.
Absolutely.
Anytime you do any virtualization, and for VDI, it's even the same, right? So our customer experiences says that virtualized desktop is probably one of their most challenging workloads they have in terms of dealing with storage infrastructure.
Yep.
You have to deal with IOPS, right? So IOPS essentially...
IOPS is the disk equivalent of megabit per second.
Right.
Right. It's how many read-write operations you can take, you can put against a disk at any given point in time. And it's very easy to calculate, right? So you take a single 700 RPM SATA drive, it'll do so many IOPS. You buy a 15,000K SATA drive or SAS drive, so many IOPS. An SSD, you know, so many IOPS. And based on what you buy, you can if you can calculate the number of IOPS you need, you can very easily figure out the number of disks you need to support that, both read and write. You then begin introducing caching technologies where they can cache data in memory, which is infinitely more faster than pulling it off even SSD. And when you get into companies like Fusion.io, for example, that do these RAM cache cards that can go in servers. And then you get into some of the storage vendors like we use XIO, which have a product called a Hyperice, which allows you to do SSD and spindles in the same unit, and it'll figure out what the hot bits are and move them from spindle to SSD. So there's all these technologies that will reduce IOPS. You just kind of got to be careful when you're shopping for these things, because storage vendors, their big thing that they hit you with is, we can do 2 million IOPS. Okay, under what conditions? Are they random? Are they sequential? What's the page size? Is it, is it a 128K page or a 4K page? Sequential read, sequential write, random read. So you've got to, it's like anything else. You got to do your homework. You can't take it at face value.
And IOPS isn't the only piece that we deal with when we're dealing with VDI. We also have to deal with storage volume.
Right.
Right? It's great we have fast disks, but if they're 16 gig, they're not usually going to do us a lot of good. So you've got to have a very wide range of options so that you can optimize what you're spending your storage dollars on, which is why I absolutely love the technologies in Windows Server 2012. You've got the ability to do storage spaces, SMV, CSVs. We're going to talk about all these things. Just new, highly scalable models that you can do with, let's be honest, JBOD, a bunch of disks, which is the picture that we have up here, where I didn't go and invest in a bunch of high-end storage units with very, very expensive I/O cards and some of these things. What I've essentially done is I can build storage spaces that have different capabilities. So, for instance, I've got some that are running on SSD. I've got some that are running 15K spindles, some running 10K spindles. And I can create all of these various spaces, these storage spaces, right? And the properties of those, so you notice here, I've got a JBOD under SSD. Well, that's where I'm going to put the parent disks. Mm-hmm. Why? Because that's where I need that I/O space. And then the VMs themselves, well, I need a little bit bigger space, but I still want some speed, so I'm going to put some 15K disks there. And then with my user disks, I'm more concerned about storage space there. Yep. So I'm going to go with some of these older version 10K drives where I can just get gobs and gobs of storage for my dollar.
Is that a technical term? Gobs and
yes,
gobs?
Yes, gobs and gobs. Excellent. That's an unofficial, official technical term.
So it's like a 3 terabyte disk is one gob?
No, I haven't actually done the terabyte to gob conversion.
Excellent, okay.
Yeah. Thanks, buddy.
You're welcome. Go back to that slide for a second, because that slide is actually an extremely good slide, even though it looks kind of confusing. So on the bottom half, where you've got spaces, we'll talk about storage spaces, but you've got three classes of storage. Call that gold, silver, bronze, right?
Yeah.
Gold's your SSD, bronze is your 15K, silver is your 15K, and bronze is your 10K. And what you're choosing to do is take the read-intensive bit, which is the parent. And this, by the way, the scenario being described here is pooled VDI. So the read-intensive disks, which is the shared parent, goes on the SSDs, as you're saying, and the rest of it goes into other types of storage. But where that's being presented is an SOFS, a scale-out file server. This is a file server for application storage that's presenting three file shares. a gold file share, a silver file share, and a bronze file share. The users, the administrators essentially don't know, you know, what those file shares are being front or behind those file shares. But all they're going to do is when they're defining their VMs, they go, well, you know, this particular component needs gold storage. So they go to the gold file share. There's no touching of storage infrastructure whatsoever. The file share is the infrastructure. And the Hyper-V clusters, they just know how to talk to it.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Again, trying to make those decisions. Those decision points are, dollar for dollar, what am I looking for? Am I looking for performance? Am I looking for a combination of performance versus volume, like storage space? And then finally, am I more concerned about the amount of space that I have for the dollar? That's really ideally kind of what this slide kind of demonstrates and what we look over. You mentioned here, Server 2012 is not your mom's file server anymore.
No, it is not. And I want me to show you why.
All right, let's do it.
We have slides in this later on, but to be quite honest, I get bored with PowerPoint after a while.
That's fine. I like demos too.
So let's go take a look at, very briefly, here I have a cluster, okay? And this is a two-node file cluster. Am I out of my spot? I'm not out of my spot. Two-node file cluster. It's got two nodes, zero, node one, node two, and these nodes are pretty straightforward. Now, I've created on this file on this cluster a file share object. Okay, so this I've just gone literally configure role, file server role, and gone through this wizard. What I've created is something called a scale out file server. Now, if you look at kind of how easy this is to do, configure role, file server. General use, this is your traditional file server, right? This is what we've always had. The new one is the scale out file server. So I click next on that. Give it a name, call it scale out file server, next, and it finishes. Now, without turning this into a clustering and storage session, the important thing to note here is that the key to making all this possible is a protocol called SMB 3.0. In order for all this to work, they had to rewrite the SMB protocol, make it more efficient, make it handle file locks that occur over a long period of time, and most importantly, configure that protocol so that it can handle disconnects. Right? You don't typically have a disconnect in fiber channel. In Ethernet, you know, the likelihood of a cluster node failure or something is a little bit higher. So it's got to be able to handle disconnects. So now, when you run workloads that are local, but you store those files in the file server, in the case of a VM, for example, the file gets locked for days, weeks, months, or years. That lock can be transferred from one node to another using SMB 3.0. With this scale-out file server, I can now go begin to add file shares to it. Now, I've already used all my storage in existing file shares, so I can't really add another one. But if you look down here, I've taken some of my storage, so I've got disks, and these are your traditional storage disks, right? So in my case, I've used iSCSI. Mm-hmm. You could use FibreCHAN. You're just going to present the disks to the cluster. And you turn those disks into cluster shared volumes. With 2008 R2, CSV was a Hyper-V only technology.
Right.
Now, it's an everything technology. So they've taken it from just Hyper-V and they've made CSV available to file shares, okay? To file servers. What that means is both nodes of the file server can actively resend and receive data at the same time against the same storage volume. So it can be active on both nodes at the same time, which brings in another kind of fairly interesting piece of technology, which is SMB multi-channel. So you start putting all those things together where I can have multiple network cards in my file servers. I can have multiple Hyper-V servers that are all on my Ethernet LAN, and that file server can take simultaneous I/O over every single network card at the exact same time, all going back against the one piece of storage. If any node fails, it seamlessly, transparently fails to the node that actually works.
Mm-hmm.
right? Now, what that gives you is incredible scalability in Ethernet-based file traffic. And let me show you an example. Let's jump back to my screen for a second. I feel like the most interesting man in the world. I don't often use Facebook in my Jumpstart presentations, but when I do, I show graphics like this. look at this graphic, and if you haven't noticed kind of what's significant about this yet, look right here.
You've sent almost 14 gig.
That's not sent. That is live transfer. That's throughput.
Okay.
That's file I/O happening right now. Now, I shouldn't say right. This is a screenshot, obviously. But if you look at this here, this was we did a deployment of a bunch of SharePoint servers, and there were SharePoint VMs, and so we put those VMs on an SMB file server. And we had, I think, 40 Hyper-V hosts that were provisioning to that same SMB share at the same time. The result of that was we had two 10-gig network adapters in a 20-gig team, and we were sustaining over about 6 hours between 9 and 18 gigabit per second sustained throughput.
Wow.
Right, and you can see it on the graph here. Like, when I took it, it was at 13, but like right about here, this line here is 20 gigabit per second.
You essentially virtually saturated your line at that point.
Yeah,
close.
Yeah, we saw spikes as high as 19. And yeah, it's just amazingly, amazingly fast throughput. That you know, the speed you get against Ethernet now is phenomenal. And so now you don't need to plumb fiber to all your Hyper-V servers to give them clustered SAN storage. You just need Ethernet.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
Now, this brings up a whole new plethora of architectural questions. Well, do I do a storage LAN?
Mm-hmm.
And you might. You might do a separate subnet just for SMB I/O. And you might run, you know, two 10-gig cables in every single file server or every single Hyper-V server to put them on a segment that all the storage file servers are on. So you've now got this 10 gigabit per second SMB 3.0 storage LAN that is much easier to configure and maintain and upgrade because you're not dealing with fiber. You're not dealing with provisioning storage modules to LUNs. All your LUNs in your SAN get provisioned to your cluster of file servers, and you present to those file shares. So instead of LUN mapping, you go new file share permission go. So IT pros can do storage now. Instead of having to go to a dedicated storage guy.
Yeah, absolutely. A couple things I've noticed through looking at the Q&A chat here. Some folks kept going over recapping, you know, gold, silver, bronze, where you should put certain things. We used an example,
yeah,
right, where your main VHD is sitting on one set, differencing disks on another, your user data sitting on another. That I use that as almost an extreme example. It's how do you need to design it for how your users work, mm-hmm, and how your world works. So ideally, you're going to want your virtual machines to exist on the fastest spindles that you possibly have, and your user data residing on things that are probably bigger but maybe slower. If you've got the funds, right, we'll quote Ferris Bueller here, I highly recommend you pick up, you know, you go all SSD if you wanted to, right?
Yeah.
It's just, it's a money versus storage versus speed, and those are the decisions that you kind of want to, take in. So I wanted to make that absolutely clear. All right, so you talk about SMB3, and let's see, here we go. Yeah, so SMB3, and this essentially is kind of a diagram. What I've got here is a diagram of really what you just kind of showed, right? Where it allows us basically to have those storage spaces, right, which you covered off, along with those clustered shared volumes, all at a single namespace. And then you mentioned the Ethernet pieces.
Yeah. One thing I'd throw in, because we throw this term storage spaces around a whole lot. Storage spaces is a technology that's in Windows Server and Windows 8 that basically allows you to take a bunch of disks and then present them as a volume. It's kind of like RAID, but at a bit of a higher level.
Right.
But it's one kind of important distinction I want to make here is that storage spaces, you can cluster them, but you can only cluster them if they are serially attached SCSI JBOD enclosures. If you have like a fiber channel, you know, EMC SAN or one of the XIOs like we use, you can't storage space those they can only be presented as traditional storage. So you see these disks here, those would be your traditional, you know, enterprise grade SAN enclosures that you're presenting back. If you want to use storage spaces, they're meant for, you know, a kind of a lower level implementation where, you know, you buy cheaper serial attached SCSI JBOD enclosures and you plug those into a server. Now the server sees all the raw disks.
Yes.
And you want some way to aggregate those disks together and present them back as one single storage entity. The spaces will do that, but only in a clustered environment. I should say, well, they'll work on a standalone server, but
yes,
if you're going to cluster them, it's got to be shared SAS.
And it's another way of us grouping, right? We talk about that gold, silver, bronze.
Yeah.
Group your SSDs together, have a space for that. Group your 10K and your 15K storage together as well. I think we talked about, you know, the SMB scale out, right? The new SMB features, so transparent failover, scale out, multi-channel, the PowerShell commandlets. So you talk about PowerShell and the things that you've got to do to manage your storage, the re-architecting of SMB3 here, and having that PowerShell, it's pretty big. I've got a link here that I'm going to go ahead and send out. It's here at the bottom of the slide. I'll send it out into the Q&A chat here in just a moment, and that way folks will have it. So I'll send that out there. So basically, Hyper-V over SMB, you can store your virtual machine files, your configuration, your VHD, your snapshots in file shares using the SMB3 protocol to get the improved performance, to get that I/O. Supported for both standalone and clustered servers, as you mentioned, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you can use Hyper-V with that shared file storage for that cluster. And then leverage that multi-channel. And why do people care? Look, it's easy.
Yep.
It's flexible. And it gives you the ability. You don't have to go and reinvest. Here's one of the frustrating things to me when I start getting in and talking about technology, Hyper-V, getting into storage technologies. A lot of times when you start talking large scale and enterprise class solutions, there is like an automatic, oh my gosh, I have to go out and fork out a ton of money and get a customized solution in order for this to work. And that frustrates me, particularly from an IT perspective, because it's like, you said it, you've got all sorts of different people coming in and saying, well, this is better, well, no, this is better, and I'm doing it this way, and I'm doing it this way. The reality here is you've got the flexibility to where you can make that choice and decision. There are not a lot of hard lines as it relates to storage. Be flexible, which is what we're offering here. Be flexible, offer that performance per dollar.
Yep.
Is really where we're coming along into these pieces. All right, let's see. Requirements, I like this. In order to use SMB3, this question gets asked all the time. One or more computers running server 2012 with file server.
Yep.
Okay.
Easy enough.
One or more running server 2012 with Hyper-V roll. Common Active Directory infrastructure.
Yeah, AD is the glue for everything, so that's a given.
Right.
It doesn't need to be 2012 AD, though.
Absolutely. And that's one of the key pieces.
Yeah, you just need 2012 on the file server, 2012 on the client component, which would be Hyper-V.
Absolutely. Standalone Hyper-V servers are supported.
Yep.
Right? It's not a high availability solution, hence the reason why they're standalone. Or if you configure Hyper-V in a failover cluster.
Yeah. And then also for Hyper-V over SMB, constrained delegation is needed. So if you look up, there's Jose Barreto did a ton of really good blog posts on how to set all this up.
Mm-hmm.
PowerShell commands, scripts, click-throughs, everything. Just do a search for it. But you got to make sure you do the constrained delegation, which is in AD on the attribute of the computer account to allow it to delegate credentials and delegate access to the file share, because now it's a three hop authentication process.
Mm-hmm. There's a little bit here that shows kind of an SMB Hyper-V cluster, right? It kind of shows, you know, how SMB shares are used for VHD storage in various scenarios.
Mm-hmm.
So if you've got a standalone file server with clustered Hyper-V, now we're going to kind of get into this. Where are you clustering?
Yeah.
Because you can cluster the Hyper-V servers, you can cluster the guests, you can cluster
if you look at this, the three variations of what are kind of the three variations. The first one on the far left is a cluster of Hyper-V servers that just use a file share as their storage point.
Yep.
Now, if it were me, I would never, ever, ever use a file share that wasn't clustered. So the second slide is you cluster the file shares. Mm-hmm. So now you've got a Hyper-V cluster using a file server cluster. Mm-hmm. And when you want to add additional Hyper-V servers to your cluster to scale it out, you don't got to provision storage for them. Mm-hmm. You don't got to add the storage in. You don't got to incur any kind of downtime. You just add the Hyper-V server, add it to the cluster, and you're done. Mm-hmm. In terms of giving it access to the storage, you plug an Ethernet cable in. That's all you got to do. You DHCP the IP address. That's all you got to do. The unless you've done it, it's hard to appreciate how good this makes things.
There's a question here wanting to know clarification around clustering a traditional file server, not a scale-out file server. It's essentially the same type of pieces there, right, Corey?
Well, yeah, it's the process is more or less the same. You go through the clustering wizard. What's different, if you start getting into the real raw technical end of things, there's a lot of things about the file server that are actually different. It's still just a file share. Like, for example, I'm going to jump on my screen for a second. My scale-out file server is HV data, and I've got a couple of shares on it. It just shows up as a file server object on the network, just like a traditional file cluster. You can ping it just like a traditional file cluster. But how it does IP addressing, how it does its names are all completely, completely different. I'm going to try a few things kind of on a whim here. Nude one. I'm going to run a command called git smb witness. Some of this stuff is in Jose's blog as well.
It's spelled witness wrong.
SMB. Help me out, Joe. ITNESS, right? No. I need a dash.
Are you not auto completing there?
No, I'm not. SMB. My God, what happened to the keyboard? Witness. Get down to the W's. Witness client. That's it. Okay.
Autocomplete is your friend.
Yeah. So if you look at this right here, what this is basically showing you is that I have a number of clients to this file share right now that are browsing this file share, and you can see that depending on the load of the file share, they're coming in on different nodes. So, for example, the VM host is using node 2 for all its I/O. This VM called Atom CX220, which is one of the computers here, is using node 1. And because I'm browsing it from my DC, I've got a connection on node 1. Mm-hmm. So what this does is when you set up a file server, unlike a traditional file server where it's active on one node and then you fail it to the other node, and when you fail it to the other node, everyone gets disconnected, the file share is active on both nodes at the same time all the time. So it dynamically load balances. Right. So if I go back to that screenshot I had right here, this is one of my file server nodes. There were four nodes in my cluster, and every one of them looked like this at the same time, because SMB 3.0 will dynamically load balance when it hits a scale-out file server. So if you've got 10 Hyper-V servers, you're not going to hit one of your nodes. You're going to hit all your nodes all the time at the same time at an equal level. And you can, through some fancy PowerShell work, transfer a workload. So if you're going to take a node offline, you can move all the disk I/O, or I should say all the SMB I/O, to one node and then take one down. Bring it up, manually move it back again. Or if it's going to fail, it'll happen automatically. So it under the hood, it's completely new and completely different. So it's definitely worth spending the time to learn.
Awesome. Last slide, CSV caching.
CSV caching, excellent. So I've got, I want to show this real quick because it applies specifically to VDI. It's a block level, you can guys go back to the slide for a second. It's a block level cache that will use up to 20% of file server memory. So if you've got 100 gigs, it'll take 20 gigs. And it'll function kind of like those, like those Fusion I/O kind of cards, where as you do heavy read off of the disk, it's going to identify the hot blocks and just drop them right in RAM. So the next time you come back, it doesn't even have to go to your disk.
So this is great for with, you know, kind of those master images, right, where you're reading a lot,
yep.
you're not actually doing writing. So this is that yeah. that VDA.
So if you take that, like, so in our example that we've got here, we have, you can jump down to my desktop here, we have on our file share, HP store, for my pool desktops, I've chosen to put my master image right here. So there's my master image. It's just in a share or in a folder within the share on the highly available file server where I told the wizard to make stuff, right? File's going to be read 100%. If I've got 50 gigs of RAM in my server, mm-hmm. and I turn on CSV caching and I turn it up to max, which is 20%, this file here conceivably could come 100% from memory, never even touch my disk. So read operations that reference blocks that are contained in the master VHD, they never hit the disk. So the performance goes through the roof. Where you really see this is if you boot a bunch of VMs. Because as you boot the VMs, they're reread intensive boot operations.
Yeah.
So the first VM boots and reads off the disk. The second one boots and reads from RAM when you turn on the CSV caching. And you'll notice that in the properties for VDI, if I look at my pool desktops, one of the things that I can actually do in here, if I look at my collection properties for pool desktops, there we go, collection properties, and I look at my storage location, one of the settings, and I skipped this when I did the wizard, is I can choose a different path right here for the virtual desktop template export location.
Okay.
So if I were trying to do this gold, silver, bronze scenario, I would have chosen a path that was covered by CSV cache and put this read-only file on it. So now, even if this storage location is bronze storage, it's not that fast, doesn't matter. It's coming out of memory. Mm-hmm. The first guy is going to pull it off the disk into memory. The rest of them are going to pull it out of memory. Now, to turn this on, which is sort of the next piece, how do I do it, right?
Okay, yeah.
Sounds, how do I do it? Well, here's how you do it. There's a bunch of counters that are all zero right now. Cluster CSV volume cache on which are all zero because it's not turned on. To turn it on, and I may very well have to reference the interweb to get the PowerShell commands because I kind of forget them. I'm going to get my cluster properties. So I'm just going to pull all the properties in my cluster down. SMB. Did I do that wrong? SMB store. I did do it wrong. Anyone that's watched me do these things, I don't pre-stage the stuff. I do it.
Yeah. Well, and it's what we would all be doing at home, right?
So. And so these are all the really gory cluster properties. And there's one down here, which is shared volume block cache size in megabytes, which is right now set to zero.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm actually going to set that. I'm going to look up the command first. I forget it.
You're going to do what every IT professional does, which is to go out and take a look at that command online, and that's also why I love working with you, because it's exactly what we
do.
It's
so slow there.
So it can take up to 20% of file server memory. While you're looking that up, are there any downside things that you really want to look at?
Not really, except that it's going to take a bunch of RAM away from your file server.
Yep.
So you want to be aware of that and kind of what it is. By the way, if you go to go to my screen here, I just did a Bing and I went CSV volume cache and I get this clustering and high availability blog entry. The wireless amount is really, really slow here for some reason. And if you scroll down, here's the commands right here.
Yep. So you've done that.
Yep. And so what I'm going to do is just go set that, get cluster, shared volume cache size, yep, in megabytes. So I'm going to do git, here we go. I'm going to run this command. Shared volume cache size?
Shared volume block cache size, yes.
Block cache, there it is, yep, block. In MB. I love these property names. I'm going to do, I got 10 gigs of RAM in the file, so I'm going to go 2,000. SMB store. So I'll just check that that took. So you can see that's now set to 2,000 right here?
Yep.
Okay. So I've effectively configured the cache size. Now what I've got to do is I've got to turn it on per volume. Okay.
Okay. So for each cluster shared volume you have, you enable
this. I need to enable this, right?
Okay.
And so to do this, it's a pretty straightforward. Get cluster shared volume, set cluster parameter, CSV enable, block cache size 1. So we'll do that real quick. Get cluster shared volume.
People are wondering why you're not using the PowerShell GUI.
PowerShell's
the ISE.
Commands. There's no such thing as a PowerShell GUI.
The ISE that'll help you with your commands.
This
because
I'm not a wimp.
Oh wow, wow! Way to insult the people out there, buddy. Yeah. I disagree with him. I actually use ISE before I use any other utility. So that's me, and I'm not a wimp either.
So.com. So there's my cluster disks. So we're going to take those and we're going to enable it. So cluster parameter, CSV enable, block cache 1. EN, CSV enable, block cache 1. So that's now enabled, and then the final step is I need to actually take the volumes, take the two cluster volumes, turn them off, just enable, disable them, or power them off, not power them off, but offline, online. That's what I'm looking for,
yep.
Offline, online, which is pretty simple to do. Before I do that, though, I just want to make sure that I have no VMs that are actually running and using it, which these two are not, which is good. So we go back into my cluster configurator. And I go to my CSV volumes, which are these two right here. And I'm just going to go offline and bring online. That's simple. Okay?
Okay.
Now it's done. Now, if the gods are good to me, what I need to do real quick is actually, so that because those were taken offline and online again.
It's just waiting for data refresh.
No. Yeah, I just the quickest way to do this I've found is to just add this piece in again.
Okay.
So node 1, and we'll go from node 1 to CSV cache. So CSV cluster CSV file system and volume cache. So we'll add those two in. I'm going to do the same thing on node 2. Now, this is a fairly dynamic technology, so it figures out when it needs to be used. So there's every chance that this will do nothing. So I'm just saying. Because it may decide it
doesn't. Because if it's not doing anything.
Well, it may decide it doesn't need to use it. But I'm historically, this should actually give you a bit of a result. So there's node 1, there's node 2. So now CSV file system, and then we have the volume cache, which right now we can see it's turned on, which is the cache state of 1. On volume 1 and volume 2. And so now we're going to go power on those VMs and see if we actually produce some data. Now these are file share based VMs, so it complained a little bit there for a second because I took the file share offline and Hyper-V console lost connection to where the VMs were stored.
Yep.
So we're going to start that again. Hyper-V Manager. Now, don't be grumpy with me.
It really didn't like you taking off that file share.
Yeah, no. I by rights needed to close the consoles first.
Oh, okay.
They'll figure it out, but it might take them a minute or two. So we may take our little break and just come back, and by that time it'll have sorted itself out.
Sure, absolutely. We can definitely do that. Let's see. Just take one quick look there again and see if you're. If not, the next module that we're going to get into, so we've talked about Hyper-V, we've talked about storage, how storage really kind of affects VDI, or actually it's more how do we architect that underlying storage so that we can gain benefits by running VDI on top of Hyper-V. Mm-hmm. We're going to show you some really great examples. I've got Adam Carter who is going to come on, and we're going to go through some performance stuff. And this is not just a few VMs running on a couple of laptops. This type of storage stuff that we'll be talking about is pretty big enterprise class stuff. I get comments all the time when I talk to folks about, hey, look, we're not an enterprise. We don't get all these benefits. The reality is I've worked everywhere from a large enterprise down to a smaller size company, small to mid-sized company, and everything that I've learned has really translated. Mm-hmm. The great thing about this technology is while, we do build it for massive scale, you can still gain advantages of this and performance.
Absolutely.
And performance per dollar by running it no matter where you are, right? And a lot of times people go, well, I'm not an enterprise, I'm going to tune out here. I highly recommend you stick around for Adam's session because he's got some amazing information coming in. So folks, stick around. We'll be right back to the Using Microsoft VDI to Enable New Work Styles. We're going to talk about performance.